Gulbarg Bashi is going to speak to us next. Ms. Bashi was born in Iran and received her early education there, and then went on to get her secondary and upper secondary education in Sweden. She went on to pursue her higher education in England, receiving a BA in Middle Eastern Studies from the University of Manchester, a Master's of Science in Women's Studies at the School for Policy Studies at the University of Bristol, and she is currently a PhD student in the Department of Theology and Religious Studies at the University of Bristol, as well as a visiting scholar at Columbia University, where she is actually writing the final draft of her dissertation. I'm so envious. Her dissertation is entitled Shia Responses to the Idea of Universal Human Rights in Iran and a Feminist Critique. I'm not sure what she's going to talk about tonight, but I suspect we'll hear some version of something that she's writing about in that. What she does is she sort of questions the privileging of the Islamist discourse over other alternatives, such as nationalist and socialist alternatives in Iran. And I look forward to hearing what she has to say tonight. In addition to all that work, she's also working on a human rights, civil rights, and women's rights projects with her husband, and getting ready to have their first child.
Thank you so much for having me. My talk is actually titled Women and War, the Hidden Victims of Crimes Against Humanity. So I'll be concentrating on sort of the women's perspective of war and what wars really mean for women and girls. So I'll just start. Back in 2001, right after 9/11 attacks, a poll in the UK showed men and women's differing attitudes towards a military attack on Afghanistan. 74% of men supported airstrikes, and only 58% of women were in favor of such attacks. Whereas 55% of men were prepared to contemplate war, only 32% of women opposed any military action if it meant war. The figures were pretty much the same in the polls of the 1990 Gulf War and the 1999 Kosovo War. In 1990, 61% of men and only 39% of women thought the UK should agree to using its troops to get to Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait. Nearly half of the women, 49%, opposed military action. In Kosovo, the gap between men and women narrowed after atrocities against Kosovan Albanians were broadcast to the world. 76% of men were in favor of airstrikes and 62% of women. A few days later, after NATO mistakenly bombed a convoy of refugees, women's support of airstrikes fell sharply to only 56%, while men's held steady. What is, however, quite interesting is that women's opposition to war and their lesser support for military action have been systematically wiped off many newspaper pages and television screens. Despite significant advances in the number of women in the media, the crisis has exposed how many of them are actually in softer areas of news, such as features and domestic stories. In a major crisis as the one we're experiencing now, the war on terror, virtually all the reporters have been men. The impression is always that it is men that perpetrate this violence, and it is men who organize the response. What this exposes is the true nature of the power structures, even in the most advanced and seemingly gender equal countries such as the UK and the United States. So while women in war-torn countries pay the highest price of war in terms of losing their lives, limbs, becoming homeless, they become also exposed to sexual violence, trafficking, and systematic rape as a war crime. The less obvious aspects of their losses is the jobs they lose, the setbacks they suffer in their long struggles for democracy and equality. Many women and girls also lose their support networks, their children, sisters, friends, husbands, brothers, fathers, people who may have had the important role of sustaining the family financially. So the psychological and financial cost of war is another aspect that we very well know about. So, but women of the states that wage these invasions and wars, such as the United States, also suffer. Women in the military, while humanizing the face of the war, pay with their lives, mental health, and limbs. So they pay with their lives, mental health, and limbs in these wars. They're systematically discriminated against in the military. They're underpaid, and many women in the United States Air Force, for example, have been subjected to rape and sexual harassment. And the nation's tax money, instead of going to welfare, medical health, and education, goes into making bombs. So women on either side of the crossfire are the ultimate losers. As the eminent American anti-racist feminist scholar and activist, Zila Eisenstein, has suggested about women, American women's loss in these wars, I quote from her. She says, U.S. imperialism attempts to humanize this extremist, militarist phase of global, yet territorial corporate building, and to women. Although women have become a significant presence in the military, their presence has not regendered the military democratically. Women have been used symbolically to humanize and democratize war making. We are told that mothers now fight alongside fathers, women alongside men. The gendered role of the masculinized warrior is now filled by either males or females, but there is little equality to be seen here between men and women, either side or outside this hierarchy. Women fly F-18s, they launch missiles, are on the front line of intelligence units. There are 200,000 active duty women in the United States military. Most of these women join the military to better themselves in a world with few options for them. For example, Private Lori P.S. Tiwa, a Hopi Indian killed in Iraq, represents the multiracial identities of women in this war. This is Iraq. These women in particular symbolize the equality of women in the so-called West to the rest of the world. The symbolic is in part true and in part not. Women in the U.S. are thought to be treated equal, modern, and free, yet most middle-class and wealthy women are not found in the military. Private Lynch, rescued in an ambush in Iraq, is West Virginia working-class poor. She's the age of President Bush's twin daughters, both attending college, far away from this war. Other women, single mums, are in the military in order to go to school. Necessity, more than equality, seems to be the guide here. More often than not, inequity and sexual harassment, rather than sexual equality, is the mark of the U.S. military. While the U.S. makes war, the U.S. Air Force, February 2003, is charged with multiple counts of rape. Upwards of 50 women finally came forward to speak out publicly against a decade worth of unfair treatment at the Air Force Academy. Several documented their rapes, their failed attempts to have their complaints acted upon, and the stone walls they encountered in trying to do so. One woman, Deborah Dickerson, tells her story of being raped Christmas Day 1981. She pressed charges. Her rapist confessed, and then the military blamed her. She says she was born poor and black and escaped poverty in large measure by enlisting in the Air Force. She became their golden girl, but in the end, she writes, quote, it was infinitely more difficult to be female in uniform than to be black. Women in khaki are juxtaposed against women elsewhere, as in the third world, even though these women elsewhere, as in Iraq, are also trying to scrape together a life for themselves and their loved ones. It is a tricky scenario to clarify. Women in military garb bespeak new gains for women who are trying to build a life of economic independence, but this is a track which is raised in class by inequities already existing in their lives. Arab women from across Egypt said no to war in Iraq and were in the front lines calling for peace and the protection of the environment and natural resources of their countries. They condemned the cost of a multi-billion dollar war when billions of women, of people across the globe have no access to potable water or proper sanitation. Given this context, women's and people of color's incursion into a military hell-bent on empire building is one of the saddest contradictions of these times. This irony may affect the women in Iraq the most cruelly. Although no friend to women, during most of Saddam Hussein's regime, they worked and studied with few restrictions compared to women in many other Muslim countries. Middle-class women were part of the professional class. They could vote, maintain custody of children after divorce. These rights began to be challenged in the last years of Saddam's rule as he sought support from Islamic extremists against the US. Women were newly required to travel with a male relative. Now, in post-Saddam Iraq, women are fearful that if Islamic Shiite extremism takes hold, that they will lose more freedoms. But it is already clear that no one in the Bush administration is watching or cares what happens to these women in Iraq. So we may wonder, why aren't women and feminists in this country opposing these wars more openly, more actively? All the evidence confirms clearly that war is bad for women. It's really bad for women. By not challenging current wars and other preemptive strikes more actively, women are in fact giving into the structure of domination. They are reaffirming the fact that men are socialized to intellectualize the world, analyze and objectify it in a bid to emotionally distance themselves and control it, and women are brought up to emphasize and have fewer such distancing techniques. So while women are paying the highest price, it's time to empathize and actually do something with all this empathy. As in all recent wars that we have witnessed on our TV screens and we've read about, in Kosovo, as in Rwanda, we know that women were not only subjected to conventional horrors of war, as in being shot, killed, maimed, but they were systematically subjected to rape, starvation, torture, and other horrors by their enemies or even by their own men. Women in Rwanda were deliberately raped by HIV-positive soldiers in rape camps in order to eradicate the next generation of their people. If we look at the prime example of women in Iraq, we see that since 2003, women and girls have not only been equally bombed and traumatized as their male counterparts, but they have been subjected to abduction, rape, and murder as a punishment for those of them who want to hold on to a professional job. I quote from a recent article in The Guardian. Quote, a women's rights campaigner, Salam, a nickname, knows about the three men in the Opal. They tried to kill her on 11th of December last year. It was a Sunday, she recalls, and 15 bullets were fired into her car as she drove home from teaching at an internet cafe. A man in civilian clothes got out of the car and opened fire. Three bullets hit her, one lodging close to her spinal cord. Her 20-year-old son was hit in the chest. Salam saw the gun, a police-issued Glock. She is convinced her would-be assassin works for the state. The shootings of Al-Talal and Salam are not isolated incidents. Even in Najaf, a city almost exclusively Shia and largely insulated from the sectarian violence of the north. Bodies of young women have appeared in its dusty lanes and avenues, places patrolled by packs of dogs where the boundaries bleed into the desert. It is a favorite place for dumping murder victims. Iraq's women are living with a fear that is increasing in line with the numbers dying violently every month. They die for being a member of the wrong sect and for helping their fellow women. They die for doing jobs that the militants have declared, decreed that they shouldn't do, for working in hospitals and ministries and universities. They're murdered too because they're the softest targets for Iraq's criminal gangs. Iraq's women live in terror of speaking their opinion, of going out to work, or defying the strict new prohibitions on dress and behavior applied across Iraq by Islamist militants, both Sunni and Shia. They live in fear of their husbands too, as women's rights have been undermined by the country's post-war constitution that has taken power from the family courts and given it to the clerics. Furthermore, Amnesty International reports that women and girls in Iraq live in fear of violence as the conflict intensifies and insecurity spirals. Hundreds of thousands of civilians are reported to have been killed or injured in military operations or attacks by armed groups since the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in March 2003. The lawlessness and increased killings, abductions, and rapes that followed the overthrow of the government of Saddam Hussein have restricted women's freedom of movement and their ability to go to school or to work. Women face discriminatory laws and practices that deny them equal justice or protection from violence in the family and community. A backlash from conservative, social, and political forces threatens to stifle their attempts to gain new freedoms. The general lack of security has forced many women out of the public life and constitutes a major obstacle to the advancement of women's rights in the country. We all know that life under Saddam Hussein's autocracy was no bed of roses for women or for Iraqi men. Women were the equal victims of political repression, torture, and execution under the Ba'ath regime, as were the men. But at least there was some order. They went to school, they went to work, there was some security in the streets, no bombs were dropped from the sky, no occupying army shot at their houses or stormed in to arrest their fathers, brothers, or husbands. They had jobs, as I said, and of course they suffered under the rule of an undemocratic and patriarchal society, while this oppression varied for women from different social stratas. And as I have said before, today, abducted, murdered, live in fear. And if a woman is abducted and murdered without a ransom, then she's just been abducted to be raped. And even those that are raped and released are not necessarily safe. They may be killed by their own family because they have been raped. So women's rights activists, they say repeatedly that they've been betrayed by their country's new constitution that guaranteed them a 25% share of membership of the Council of Representatives. That guarantee has turned instead into a fig leaf hiding what they now call a human rights catastrophe for Iraqi women. Report after report show in every and almost every area of human rights, women are being seriously discriminated against, in some cases seeing their conditions return to those of females in the Middle Ages. In areas such as the Shia militia stronghold of Sadr City in East Baghdad, women have been beaten for not wearing socks and all sorts of things. Iraqi women have, of course, been beaten, jailed, raped, and killed by the occupying American and British forces too, and they have borne the psychological trauma of the men in their family and neighborhoods. We all know that war and civil unrest increases also domestic violence. So if you've had domestic violence prior to a war, you will have an increased level of domestic violence. And add this to the loss of your loss of support networks, friends, family, community, work, food, medicine, shortage, and all sorts of things, and you have a real humanitarian crisis. And of course, the men suffer immensely too. They lose in larger numbers with their bodies, their limbs, and their mental health. Any Vietnam veteran can testify to this tragedy, and more Iraqi, American Iraqi war veterans will unfortunately testify to this soon too. So what is alarming for any human rights, women's rights, or anti-war activists in this country is that in all the recent wars, the neocon doctrine has been adopted to persuade the American public into going to war in the name of democracy and the liberation of women. This claim is categorically false and indeed criminal. Not only are the intentions of going to these wars not in order to promote any such thing as democracy or human rights or women's rights, however one can do so by bombing a country into liberation, the consequences of such wars are catastrophic setbacks and direct crimes against women's human rights and for humanity at large. As committed activists, our task is not allowing the women's rights issue or the matter of democracy to get hijacked in the name of war. It is our duty to oppose and expose the cause of women and or the marginalized from being used by statesmen or military men or native informers posing as feminists and activists from the targeted countries for acts of violence. we must repeatedly ask ourselves if these statesmen or military men or native informers really believe in the full emancipation of women in their own countries. We must ask, does Rumsfeld or Wolfowitz care for black or working class women's welfare in New Orleans before they go on to liberate Muslim women? The native informers, posing as defenders of the cause of women from their country of birth, not only haven't got a blasted clue about women's long efforts for bringing democracy and equality to their countries, but are supporters of the same capitalist anti-women policies which denigrate women in the developed so-called West here at home. As Zila Eisenstein states, the US at present is not what a democracy looks like, neither is feminism one and the same with the Bush administration's appropriation of women's rights talk on behalf of Afghan women or women in the US military. In a fragile civil society such as Iran, where women have, despite all legal and cultural limitations, achieved excellence in fields such as literacy, education, art, journalism, law, and political participation, the last thing women or Iranians need in their noble struggle for democracy is an illegitimate and immoral American-led invasion. Our nightmare now is that Iranian women and girls may not only have to deal with the daily hardships of life under a theocracy, but may indeed have to bear the terrorizing consequences of a US-led invasion, with all the implications for women I just explained, as in the Iraqi situation. Left to their own devices, women in Iran, as elsewhere, will surely pave the way for democratic societies one day. Thank you.